Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers number 44, Spooky Action at a Distance. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/44, and these include links to the papers we discussed in the program and links to related shows. Hey Randy, what's going on?
Good to hear from you, Jim.
So, was this your idea or was this my idea, or did you have this idea after I gave you this idea, or what was going on with this idea?
Well, I originally thought that this recent experiment about the Wigner's friend experiment would be interesting because that's been going around, and apparently, from the articles about it anyway, apparently that experiment leads to either one of two conclusions: either objective reality doesn't exist, or we're in basically a block universe and there's no such thing as randomness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that brought up the topic of entanglement, and then you found some papers here that talk about spooky action at a distance. Between this and another idea, I think the Bohm idea, we went with this one.
We can leave that Bohm one for later. I know you love Bohm, but
I kind of lost interest in Bohm, and this is kind of unfair to Bohm. When they found out that the liquid drop experiments they were doing, the Eves cooled air experiments, where they had said that they could replicate like wave interference and everything, and it was all based on Bohmian mechanics, they thought, and that turned out to be untrue. That was a mistake. I kind of was like, oh, I thought we had a mechanistic analogy for quantum phenomena. And then all of a sudden that went away, and I felt very depressed about that.
That's sad.
Because that was neat.
I mean, I remember that, and I amended our pilot wave hydrodynamics episode. I amended that, and I put a link to that. But just because some guy said so doesn't mean it's true. Did the people who were doing the original experiment concur? Is that what you heard, or is...
It was my impression that it had been attempted to be replicated by at least one serious academic group, and maybe more. And it turned out that it couldn't be replicated, so the wave interference claims weren't true, and I think that the original authors acknowledged that they had made a mistake. But whatever it is that I read left me the impression that it was dead in the water. But I'll have to go take a closer look and see what the arguments were and everything, but I'm pretty sure that they tried it experimentally under the same conditions, and they weren't able to get the effect.
Okay, well, then that's an issue. Although, I mean, it is kind of weird if other people were able to get similar effects, but I guess that's... So, I mean, we've seen the video, right?
Well, we've seen the video of the thing bouncing around, but I don't think that the video really showed the interference pattern, did it?
Possibly you have to do some analysis for the interference pattern. It's sort of like that experiment where you turn the electron gun down, right? You turn that filament temperature down and you...
Do it one at a time.
Yeah, you slow your rate of generation of electrons so that your electron gun shoots one through slits at a time. So there's no way that an electron can interfere with another electron because only one electron exists over the entire time of flight. In that case, you just have to add up all of those events, and then you get to see your interference patch, which is what makes that such a compelling experiment, right? Okay, well, then I was going to suggest we do that for episode 50, but instead we'll find something else to go back to.
Okay. I'm kind of intrigued about the entropic gravity that we talked about last time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I realized while I was thinking about it afterwards that it didn't seem like he really explicitly laid out how his equations work in order to show how entropy yields space-time and gravity. Now, I don't know, maybe that was in the second paper, the much longer paper that we didn't cover, but I would love to know how that actually works. Like how do you end up with a space-time manifold based on the entropy model that he has? Because that was what he was claiming.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, that second paper that you talked about, or that second paper that you sent me, might have something to do with that, but that jumps around so much that I'd really like to do that with something that talks about something a little more concrete, right? I'd like to do that in conjunction with something that discusses the underlying physics that guy's just bringing in and then doing the entropic gravity stuff on. So it would be interesting to do something like that with, say, the non-commutative geometries or something like that, and to try to figure that out, because that was probably the most interesting part of that paper, which was somehow with the non-commutative geometry and the entropic gravity stuff, he puts those together and he gets gravitation. And that makes a reasonable amount of sense. At least, I mean, it makes sense something like that could happen if those two things are true. So that would be a fun thing to look at as well. Although non-commutative geometry might be hard.
Yeah, that does sound pretty tricky. Does it it's also ringing a bell because I was thinking while I was going over these papers about the tests of entanglement, the EPR correlations and everything, the Bell inequalities. I was constantly thinking about the Griffiths paper that we had covered back in the Consistent Histories Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. And I think that he was talking about non-commuting operators there also. So apparently that's where he came up with the model that we're just using the wrong mathematics. And that's why there appears to be an entanglement phenomenon, but it's basically just an illusion by using classical math with quantum phenomena. So it's interesting that that came up in a totally different context.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because before I was giving the finals this morning, I found a paper from Griffiths that he put up on the archive in January.
Oh, a new one. Good.
Quantum Nonlocality, Myth and Reality. And it's all basically about this stuff and that stuff.
Oh, geez. Fantastic. Now we know what we've got to talk about.
That's something we can talk about in the future if we can find something to pair it with. But it's all about Bell-type inequalities and stuff like that.
Okay, good. My head kind of hurts when I look at this stuff because I haven't looked at the whole aspect experiment and all this EPR stuff for ages. But I think it seems like these papers, and we should talk about those, I guess. We're looking at three papers and two different comments. The three different papers that we're looking at is quantum nonlocality based on finite speed causal influences leads to superluminal signaling. I think that's a 2013 paper. And then there's another paper we read, testing the speed of spooky action at a distance, a 2008 paper from Salart and a team of people. And there was a comment on that. And then there's a third paper, lower bound on the speed of non-local correlations without locality and measurement choice loopholes. But there's find that on the archive. You have to look it up under bounding the speed of spooky action at a distance. And that's a 2013 paper. And then there was a comment about it, but that comment looked totally whacked to me. But there was a comment on that also. I don't know how that read to you, but it seems like that guy was just kind of trying to promote his own theory by making an objection that said, well, I've got a theory that says you haven't closed the loopholes, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Probably we should get to the loopholes later, unless you want to get to the loopholes first.
No, we got to go over the broad strokes first.
What are the broadest strokes?
It looks like what they're doing is basically a variant of the original aspect experiment, right? Where you have a source of entangled photons and you send them in opposite directions, and then you send them through diffraction gratings, polarizers, and you see if they're correlated, right? So because they're outside of each other's light cone because they've been moving in the opposite direction at the speed of light. So they can't be influencing each other.
That's exactly what this is. These are really, really big aspect experiments, really, really big EPR experiments on the order of 16-kilometer experiments. So we've got two experiments. One is in Geneva and one is in Qinghai.
I missed the name of the place in China. I thought it was cool. What was it like? One was like a fishing town where something was one of the labs is located in.
Yeah, it looks like this is Qinghai, Qinghai, in the western PRC. So probably out there in the desert.
Okay. So you're a lot better with those pronunciations than I am, so I'm glad you got that.
I just made it up.
Did you? You're awful. Jesus, I thought you were like being all respectful. But they seem to have done a better job because the Chinese team took into account some objections in the comment that came up after testing the speed of spooky action at a distance, the Salart experiments.
So I guess we should sort of talk about what these guys are going to test, because that actually makes a difference about these comments, I think. It might not, but
okay.
I think it does. So these guys want to talk about how quickly information would have to transfer between these two positions in order for there to be a correlation that makes sense in the way we talk about correlations. When we normally talk about correlations, they're saying we either think about causation, you know, event one begets event two, and event two begets event three, and so forth and so on. One is a cause of two. And the other thing we think about is sometimes there's just a correlation, but the two things aren't causing each other, so that means there was a third earlier event, an event zero, that begat both one and two. And those are the ways in classical probability theory you would have correlations between variables, between random variables. The problem with quantum mechanics is you have these entangled particles, and you get correlations that it just doesn't make sense that you'd be able to have them. And in one of these papers that we read, it says that in that case, the quantum correlations come from outside of space-time.
Yeah, that's a pretty ominous-sounding phrase.
That's right.
The old ones are encroaching upon our reality.
Yeah, so you don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
And you're not really sure if you want to. If you heard those squeaks, then probably that was the old ones breaking through the into space-time.
Yog-Sothoth.
Anyways, they're trying to look at these correlations, and you have these correlations that don't seem to have any information pass between two events. And if so, there's some possibility that if there's a privileged reference frame, there's one true reference frame, and might be even less privileged than that, but, you know, it's one of these things that sometimes comes up in some interpretations of general relativity and so forth.
And just so that doesn't sound crazy, people commonly refer to the cosmic microwave background radiation as giving you an opportunity to have a preferred reference frame, because if the temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation is basically homogeneously distributed around you evenly, then you could say that you're at rest, but you would be redshifted or blue-shifted with respect to it if you accelerated. So that's one way it could happen.
That's one way it could happen, and I believe in string theory you have that same kind of problem, is that there is a privileged reference frame. So there are a lot of places where these privileged reference frames show up, and the question is that something that's a problem with the theory, or is that something that's really there, and all of this relativity stuff is just an artifact of a more fundamental theory? That's what string theory is saying, right? String theory is saying all this relativity stuff comes from string theory. But if you have such a privileged reference frame, it's possible to have information between these entangled particles, but only if it travels faster than the speed of light.
You've seen a lot of that in the past, where people are saying that if there's a remote influencing happening with these correlations in the EPR experiment, then, or the Bell inequalities experiment, I guess I should say, then it would have to be some kind of something traveling faster than the speed of light, you know, like significantly faster than the speed of light. And in the first paper, they looked at this and they actually found a really fascinating and glaring logical error in that assumption. They showed that if you had like a four-partite system that you could show with a Minkowski diagram, and I think it was figure 3 where they showed this, that if you had a faster than light transfer of influence between these quantum systems, that you could end up transferring information within a rest frame observer's light cone that would give you superluminal information, right? So you'd be able to do superluminal signaling, and that seems impossible. So it looked to me like they were ruling out all classes of options where there could be some kind of communication happening between the entangled particles at any velocity between the speed of light and infinity.
I think that's probably what, in the end, they were trying to get across with that paper.
But the weird thing to me, the weird thing about that, their argument, though, is that it can only rule out velocities between infinity and C, but it doesn't rule out infinity. They're saying that for this theoretical argument reason, the correlation has to be infinite in speed. If that doesn't smack of a proof that you're not looking at a real physical effect, I don't know what the hell does.
Well, I mean, it is a real physical effect because we can do stuff.
But what I mean is that sounds like Griffiths would have to be right.
I think that's what Griffiths' paper is trying to say, right? But I haven't read it. I've only read the abstract, but that does sound like what Griffith's paper is trying to say. It's trying to say something about there's an issue with the way you're trying to talk about these things that makes it look like there has to be some sort of information transfer that's faster than light occurring.
And these guys are saying that that information transfer would have to be infinitely fast, right?
Yes, but I mean, that's also a way of interpreting what's going on, to say that there has to be information transfer. So somebody who's a real Copenhagen purist would say that there is no information actually transferring.
It gets tricky when you say information because there is no signaling. You can't communicate faster than the speed of light. We know that. So when we're saying information, we're just referring to a quantum state.
there was at one point a sort of open quantum state between two particles that were so distant that there's basically no communication in the normal sense between them. And that state has some conservation laws applied to it so that if you make one decision over here, or if you do a measurement over here and you read something, that's correlated to what's going to happen on the other side. But in some way, without this information transfer, and in fact, these experiments are set up in such a way to try to avoid saying that there's any way it could have been communicated in any possible fashion. And I think more things that I looked at this morning is that in 2015, there were like three other experiments like this that were done, although they weren't talking about the speed of spooky action at a distance, which is much cooler than just saying, well, we're trying to close all the loopholes in our Bell inequality test. So they were basically taking all the learning based on the criticisms of these tests and making even better tests. And in all of those loophole-closing tests, they're just trying to get rid of every single possibility that something in the past could have had anything to do with what's happened during the measurement, other than the entangling of the two particles.
So the Copenhagen interpretation is basically that the two particles have like a shared wave function, or their wave functions are intrinsically coupled in some kind of superposition state until the wave function collapses during measurement. That's the Copenhagen variety, right?
Well, that is the quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics is you have the wave functions, and the wave functions are only this pair of wave functions. They're not two separate wave functions. So you have this one wave function that has these two particles in it. The complete description of the state of those two particles is that wave function. So if you wander over and you make a measurement on one, and you find it's in one eigenstate of the wave function, that's going to result in the other one being in a particular state, because that's what that eigenstate says, right? It says the left one's up, the right one's down, or the right one's up and the left one's down. Unless I just said the same thing twice. I'm never sure when I do that.
Sorry. I just got the idea and moved on. Sorry about that. You'll know about it when you go back and edit. You'll be like, oh, shit, I did.
So anyways, that's just what the quantum mechanics says. Now, if you take it that these two particles have an independent reality, then you say there must be some sort of signaling between them. But in that Copenhagen interpretation, you don't have to say that. In fact, you just try to say nothing at all and just say, and only the math means anything, which sounds a little cowardly to me, except, you know, it was by the most belligerent person in physics.
But, you know, often it's the bullies who speak loudest, my friend. He just basically bludgeoned everybody to agree with him. I mean, he tried to dominate conversations and everything and try to make everybody feel like an idiot for questioning him, and that strong-arming people is no way to win an argument.
I've noticed that the best way to win an argument is to be the least rational person involved.
Yeah, you're right. Look at politics.
So, all you have to do is get to the point where everybody else says, you know, I want lunch.
Yeah.
And it works. It works all the time.
So the Copenhagen interpretation wants us to think that two particles can move apart from a single point of origin, both moving at the speed of light, and yet still remain like basically one particle until a measurement is made on one of the two components.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a composite version of the two particles. So really, if you're looking at the Copenhagen interpretation, you're not saying that you have two particles in the wave function, or two particles described by the wave function. You're saying you have one wave function, and when you measure it, you have two particles.
But, I mean, there's a dimension to it, right? I mean, some component of the wave function is moving in opposite directions to the speed of the light. You know, it's like, how does that work? How can you have a connection between two points that are moving apart that fast?
For the Copenhagen interpretation, it's just the mathematics.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I forgot about that. Stop looking for physical explanations.
Yeah, at least for some versions of the Copenhagen interpretation, it's just the mathematics. For others, people will try to say that you should not be thinking about something like this in terms of ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics in the first place. And I'm not sure if that really helps, but they seem to think it helps, or they think it'll shut you up because you don't want to deal with the quantum field theory. But sometimes that quantum field theory does help. Not all the time. I don't think it necessarily improves your understanding about what's going on if you do all these complicated path integrals to say, okay, we've got this bunch of paths, and we have that bunch of paths, and this bunch of paths does this, and that bunch of paths does that. But still, in the end, you only make one measurement, and you know it's because of the phases adding up or something. I don't really think that that helps the interpretation most of the time.
Yeah, it doesn't give me any deeper insight into entanglement, these kind of aspect-style experiments.
So that's where we were in this case, because they were saying that in this privileged reference frame, you could have information passing between these two particles. Then you could have something like two particles to talk about. And most importantly, you can measure that number and figure out how fast these particles are going.
I like that argument. Instead of just measuring the speed of the lower bound on the speed of the correlation, they looked at a really cool theoretical argument and were able to illustrate it convincingly to show that if these correlations move less than infinity, then you can communicate with superluminal signaling.
Yeah, and that second paper also talks a little bit about these multiple particles. It has at least a reference to them.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
But I didn't look it up, so I can't tell you how cool it is.
Well, I think they were referencing this work, weren't they?
Possibly. I originally found these so long ago that I don't remember what I was doing to find these. I think I was looking at the Bell stuff, and then I saw the spooky action at a distance in the time thing, and I said, oh, cool, and then I looked for a few references based on that, and it seemed like there were enough of them to talk about something. But, I mean, if so, these are almost contemporaneous. This second experimental paper, that Chinese, that one came out after the quantum non-locality based on finite speed causal influences paper.
Oh, so that's where I remember hearing them talk about their argument. So the next one that we looked at was testing the speed of spooky action at a distance, and that was actually a detailed experimental analysis, and that was Geneva?
You know, down at the southern edge of Lake Geneva, right, there's a place called Geneva. You have to remember, this is Switzerland, this is not Wisconsin.
Right.
Then they have two towns that I just realized that I forgot to look up how to pronounce Saltini and Jesse, or whatever they call themselves. And they're about 18 kilometers apart, almost east and west on either side of Lake Geneva. And so they have these fiber optic cables going from Geneva to both of these spots. And so they have a source in Geneva, and they have detectors in Saltini and Jesse, and they do some stuff with that.
Don't be so technical, Jim.
Yeah, and they do some stuff, yeah. They use those detectors to determine whether or not there are correlations. And these are a different kind of correlation than the one you're used to, because these are temporal correlations, spatiotemporal correlations.
How does that tie in with the fringing that you're talking about? Well, how does that all work?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, you're talking about these temporal correlations, and I remember them talking about the fringes that they were detecting, giving them their correlation data. What are they talking about there?
Okay, so I'm not completely sure. I did look up the Franson interferometer, which is the way they were doing this. And that's basically, you have a source, and then you have this huge distance between these things, and at the end you have an interferometer. That interferometer has two paths that, based on the state of your particle, it can either go in the long direction or it can go in the short direction. And apparently, due to the conservation laws, if it goes through the long way one way, it still has to go through the long way on the other one. And so you get correlations based on that. The fringes are probably interference fringes based on the data, where they look at how the oscillations in those fringes behave so they can figure out something about the entanglement state.
So it was a post thing that they probably had to do. I was thinking that when they're actually seeing some kind of fringe, and I'm like, well, how does that work if they're going to opposite detectors?
Yeah, they can't do anything really like that. And in fact, in this case, well, maybe they could in this case, because, right, they made a bit of a faux pas in this experiment where they left one of the detectors in one state. And so possibly they could have looked at something in real time by saying, well, I already know what the state is on the other side, so I can just sort of decide at this other detector whether or not I'm getting interference or not. Mm. But really, you should be randomly switching the paths on both sides.
Right.
Which is one of the things they're going to complain about in the comment. That's more or less what they did, right? They have a source, which is a different source in different experiments, but still parametric down conversion, I think. So the one's lithium niobate. I guess it's got a continuous wave pump for this parametric down conversion. So I think it's the same effect, just with different materials. And so that gets you your entangled photons.
Right, because you split a photon into two components, and then the two components are by nature entangled.
Yeah, you know, they have to conserve momentum, they have to conserve energy, but they were produced at the same time, so their quantum states are entangled, or basically you have a wave function with more degrees of freedom, which sort of correlates to the number of particles in the wave function, described by the wave function. And then they have a Michelson interferometer at the other end, and they use that Michelson interferometer to figure out what's going on.
Okay, because they're using the rotation of the Earth and everything.
Yeah, they're using the rotation of the Earth because apparently that's the way to find where the
Trevelich reference frame is. And that, of course, they didn't find.
I don't know. They used that to find the lowest possible speed of the speed of quantum information. I would assume that that would be the privileged reference frame if it existed.
Mm-hmm.
But I also assume that this is not sufficient to prove that there is a privileged reference frame. So when they say we found the speed of quantum information, which is what, 10,000 times the speed of light?
Yeah.
The minimum possible speed of quantum information transfer for entangled particles is really, really big. That doesn't necessarily mean that there is a speed of quantum information. It doesn't mean that they found the privileged reference frame. That just means that if everything we did would have found the privileged reference frame, then the speed of quantum information would be this size.
So they're just putting bounds on it. And there was an interesting point. I can't remember if it was this paper or the third paper that we looked over, where they said that even if the Earth is moving at like 90% the speed of light relative to this hypothetical privileged reference frame, then the speed of quantum information in that model would have had to be, you know, it's like 1,000 times the speed of light or something like that.
I think that's probably this one. I don't remember seeing a number in that last paper.
Okay.
So that was that paper, basically what it was trying to say. Since that's where we got the first set of arguments, I guess now we can talk about those loopholes.
Oh, and the comment on that paper, testing the speed of spooky action distance, Johannes Koffler and Rupert Ersin, these are people from the University of Vienna. And they pointed out what you were talking about, you know, like, hey, you've got a static state on one of your detectors and then the other one's changing. There are ways to explain these correlations in that scenario, basically without any kind of entanglement or or quantum phenomena going on. Like, it's not even a test of the PR paradox, right?
If you don't have the random states, then you're probably not really checking the EPR paradox, which tests technically local realism, right? Which basically means one of these two things is not true. Causality or locality. One of those two things breaks down. People always choose locality over causality.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to deal with the non-local concept than it is to deal with a non-causal universe.
Yeah. Now, we've talked a little bit about causality elsewhere, right? Where, you know, retrocausality, we're talking about Aharonov's stuff. That's not the end-all, be-all, and, you know, we have to look at Griffiths at some point now. So there might be even more to the story than that.
Yeah, I mean, with retrocausality and with Aharonov's book, we were going over, it seems like that kind of expands our understanding of causality without completely undermining it. Yeah, it still permits us to live in a universe that makes sense, but it also shows that the future is shaping some of those events in a way.
Well, yeah, you can't have just something completely random, right? Because then we know it's not really true. But you also don't really want to have something completely non-local, because then there's, well, the problem we're talking about right now. What does it mean that in some way information has to transfer faster than the speed of light? What is that information transfer? What's carrying it? Apparently nothing can carry that information. Right. So how does that actually work? Even if you go through and you say that local reality can't be true, talking about some sort of non-local causal effects doesn't make any more sense, other than the math says it must be true. But that's just math. So anyways, yeah, they had some problems with this. One of those was that they have some other issues with the visibility and stuff like that. So I did go to another paper, so I was saying that there were a couple of papers later on that were good. And actually, there's another one I printed out, but it ends up being a review paper that goes through these things, these loopholes. But as a review paper, it's long, and I can't read all that.
People have come up with all kinds of possible loopholes to explain these quantum correlations, right?
Probably, but you know, there are three big ones that they're really worried about. One is the locality loophole. They want to make sure that there's a complete space-like separation between the two events, the two detection events. That way they can't talk to each other. That's the easiest one. You just make them far, far away, right? You say, okay, well, I'm going to send a photon one way, I'm going to send a photon the other way, which is pretty much what's happened in these experiments that we're talking about today.
Right. Then they make their measurement almost instantaneously on both points.
Yeah, so they make those measurements instantaneously. They've gone through a lot of trouble to make sure that these lines are exactly the same length long, right? You know, they're 17 kilometers and they want to be down to the millisecond that these things are supposed to get there. Possibly better than that, but I don't know what their error is.
I think it was like 300 nanoseconds or something.
For this Geneva test, you know, they made a giant loop in one of these, like a 300 meter loop or something like that, in one of these things so that it would be the same length, right? Not just a little bit of dicking around at the edges. They actually put a big loop in one and they made the other one sort of wavy and, you know, all sorts of things to try to get the exact right time for these things. And it's a very, very shallow triangle that they end up making. So even though everything's not in a straight line, it's a very shallow triangle. So that there's just no way that they can do that. Then they have what they call the freedom of choice loophole. So we did the locality loophole. Then we have a freedom of choice loophole. That's saying that what we were just saying before, that the end measurements should be randomly selected and independent of one another. And so we're going to get to hear a lot about this in the next experiment. But, you know, you basically just randomly choose these different states, and you have to choose them in such a way that the choices still have a space-like separation, right? So that whatever's generating this random choice on the right has a space-like separation from whatever's causing this space-like separation on the left, and both of those also have a space-like separation with the generating event from the source.
And I think I remember reading about an experiment where they used like telescopes trained on galaxies billions of light years away to randomly select based on, I guess, the polarization of the incoming photons for each end of this experiment. So that there was absolutely no chance that coming from opposite ends of the universe, these, you know, oppositely pointing telescopes getting these photons could have been anything other than random, because everybody's always questioning like, well, how can you be sure it's random? And uncoupled, right?
This next paper, right, the lower bound of the speed of non-local correlations, blah, 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 blah. They just said they used a quantum random number generator, right? And that's going to end up being a problem later on. That didn't really tell you very much. Another one of these experiments, one of these ones that I said that happened later, the one from Boulder, NIST did a paper, Strong Loophole-Free Tests of Local Realism, that came out in PRL in 2015. There were two others that did similar things. That's where I'm getting the characterizations of the loopholes. That one did stuff like use old episodes of Cheers or something to generate the random numbers.
Get that, what, like your random pixel hunting or something?
Yes, something like that. Or it's a pseudo-random source that is composed of various popular culture movies and TV shows, as well as the digits of pi processed together through an XOR gate. So an exclusive OR gate. Oh, it doesn't say Cheers. It says it used Back to the Future. I mean, you have to specify everything.
You have to pick your entertainment right.
And, you know, they check how good it is through a sequence checker. So there's a pseudo-random number sequence checker that's available at www.formilab.ch/random/. And so that's what they use. CH stands for Switzerland, obviously. So that's how they figure stuff like that out. You can check through this website whether or not your pseudo-random number generator is random enough for whatever it is you need to do. That's how I think they do that sort of thing, is just use a checker to check if your random number sequence is sufficient.
That's interesting. You can make a program that will tell you who's more random than another.
One of the things they were mentioning in this paper from the guys in Boulder was that your freedom of choice loophole is never in principle closed, because there's always going to be some event far enough in the past that, you know, no matter what you do, all the different places that you're trying to get a space-like separation with are going to not have a space-like separation from that point. And so whatever's going on at that point, at that event, could be influencing all the other three, or four, or seven, or whatever it is.
It's kind of like a probabilistic butterfly effect.
Yeah, we'll see that again. And then the third of these things, it's a fair sampling loophole, or a detector loophole, the same thing. That's basically saying that if you have too much loss, you're going to see what looks like a correlation when there's no correlation. And that number, according to this Eberhardt guy, in a different paper than the one they keep referring to, is 2/3. You need at least 2/3 of your particles to go through. Otherwise, you're going to have something that's going to look like you have...
chance correlations, basically, right?
That's right. I guess I should have mentioned that Eberhardt is the guy who first talked about this privileged reference frame in a 1989 article that's in a book that the article costs $30, which so I didn't buy it.
Oof.
All right. So I wanted to look up that particular paper to see exactly what he said, but I don't think that was worth it.
Well, he proposed this whole style of experiment, right, of having your detectors oriented east-west and the same latitude, basically, and all that.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Science should be free to the world. You know what I mean? Like, all of these really seminal landmark papers. I mean, everybody should be able to read this stuff. Don't understand why it's paywalls on stuff. I mean, a lot of these papers are 30 or 40 years old. You know, it's like, holy crap. When does the copyright expire on this stuff so that people can freaking stay current?
Well, I mean, you'll have to ask Walt Disney. It's all because of him that the copyright lasts longer and longer and longer, right? So, yeah, it'll be 75 years right now, I think. I have a feeling that if it was really considered a seminal paper and people really cared that much about it, I would have been able to find a free copy sitting around somewhere.
Right. On somebody's website, yeah.
But it's apparently not something somebody decided, oh, I have to scan that and give to my students. In any event, you know, he made this paper, he made this experiment, but he also did the stuff for this third loophole that says you need at least 2/3 of your things to go through.
And in these experiments, that threshold was actually way better than 2/3, right? It was like 97% or something, or 90%.
Well, the visibility is getting down to a little over 0.7 for these. So,
oh, that's it. Okay.
According to this one, it varied with time, right? So I'm assuming that this number 2/3 is the same as the visibility. I'm not completely sure. Okay, well, actually, they have the threshold value. So where they have, instead of 2/3, it's 1 over the square root of 2 is what they're saying is the threshold value for these experiments to work. So I assume that this number, the 2/3, is supposed to be the visibility, because that's pretty close. That's interesting, because one of the Vienna criticisms of the Geneva test was that this visibility was still a little bit too low. But according to all the things that I've seen elsewhere, I guess it should be sufficient. The most interesting thing that I saw in there is that they said you probably should have, one, the fast switching rate between settings so that there's no way to do that, but really should have a chained Bell inequality. And I don't know what that is, and they didn't give me a reference. Unless this paper, Two Photon Franzen Type Experiments in Local Realism, talks about it. Actually, that is. That's why I have a little arrow at it. So anyways, I did not look at the chain Bell inequality, even though I have a little arrow pointing towards this article. Basically, both of those last two criticisms, the freedom of choice, because one of those detectors was set, and the fair sampling, because it thought that how close occasionally these visibilities came to the threshold was sufficient to disregard whatever it was they were doing.
Yeah, I've reached a better visibility than one reported. That's why that in the third paper, they got their visibility better than 91.3%.
Yeah, they tried to fix some of these things up. They used the quantum random number generator, and they improved their visibility so that apparently that would improve all of these things. Well, it's 87.6%. So if that's true, then you have a much better situation. But I still didn't see the number. I still don't see the speed. Where is the speed? Oh, it's still 4 orders of magnitude of the Earth's speed. 4 orders of magnitude greater than the speed of light on Earth. So it's the same lower bound, basically, as the previous paper, only they tried to close some of those loopholes.
I see here that they said they achieved timing accuracy better than 1 nanosecond.
Well, there were a couple of things that were a little bit better, right? So this was a direct east-west orientation according to these coordinates that they gave us, right? Both of those things are at the exact latitude as the other, 36 degrees, 33 minutes, and 15.31 seconds. So that's pretty close to as accurate as you're ever going to see.
They found ultimately a kind of similar result. Didn't they put a lower bound on the speed of any possible signaling interaction at like 10,000 times the speed of light or something like that?
Yeah, that's exactly the same number.
But they closed the loopholes, but they got the same level of accuracy, the same lower bound, yeah.
A lot of these things with the loopholes, I mean, they're just kind of academic. They're just, I don't think in those cases you're really worried about the speed that the signaling would have to have, right? In those cases, you're really trying to say, is there some way that somebody could possibly not believe me? So this first paper is perfectly good,
yeah.
Right? It tells you exactly what was going to be sold, right? But there are some things in the execution where somebody who really, really doesn't want to believe you can rationally say they still don't believe you.
Right. It almost becomes like a philosophical debate.
A little bit. But you can write a grant and get lots of money for it, and your boss will be happy. I mean, if you're trying to say that there's some instantaneous information transfer of any sort, then you probably need to have this kind of banality, because that is not something people should be accepting just because they love the math. That's something you should be trying to find ways to understand why it's happening, even though it doesn't make any sense that it's happening.
Yeah. We're physicists, so we're going to ask you to believe this completely unphysical thing. It doesn't happen from within this space-time. It's happening from outside space-time. It's like, wait, what?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just what the one guy said. But yes, it's like, how can you have correlations without information transfer? You know, there has to be some way for there to be correlations rather than just, well, the math says they have to be there. There has to be some reason why the things are correlated. And what we're saying is that they're not correlated from the source, because from the source...
So are we really sure of that? Are we really sure that they're not correlated from the source? Isn't that what Robert Griffiths was arguing in that consistent histories interpretation paper?
Yeah, the consistent histories interpretation is going to say that they are correlated at the source. You just don't know which correlation they have. There are a bunch of different possibilities that have some sort of logical connection to one another. And when you make your entanglement, you've chosen one of those things, as I recall. And then when you make your measurements, you find out which one of those you'd previously chosen. And then you get a set of different possibilities for the next measurement. At least that's how I remember interpreting what he was saying.
Yeah. That's what I remember, too. That's my takeaway, anyway. This is such an appealing argument. I feel like we've got to go look and see if anybody has made a counterargument to that.
I'm sure somebody has. I'll see if, with this paper, there's anything to go along with it like that. I mean, there are lots of different ways people are trying to interpret the same thing. Somebody has got to have said, not only that I believe this, somebody has got to have said, I don't believe that because of this. I mean, it's got to be out there.
Okay, let's see if we can find any good, compelling arguments, because I'd like to know what they are. I mean, I totally get why Einstein found this so revolting.
Well, I mean, the more you think about it, that should revolt you, right? I mean...
Yes.
Okay, so did you want to go over the Sheehan rebuttal?
You know, I read that, but it just sounded, like I said, I mean, it didn't read convincingly to me. I don't know if it was ever published anywhere. Yeah, that's part of my problem. I don't really know how to evaluate a comment. Like, if I find a comment about something on an archive, how do I know that it has any merit?
It might not. I have no idea where it was. I mean, it sounded like that comment was published somewhere because, you know, you have this thing that looks like a comment, which is like 2 pages or something. And then after that, you have another 6 pages of them just going off their rocker. And it sounds like they got a comment from somebody about their comment that really pissed them off.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were doing all the things I was just saying. Remember, we were saying that it's impossible to close the freedom of choice loophole. And that's a big part of what they were talking about is how can you be sure that the quantum random number generator is not predetermined? And sounds like the guys who wrote this paper, who wrote the Qinghai paper, it sounds like at some point they responded to this and said, well, that's the consensus. The interesting thing that they were talking about is probably the thing that you were picking up on that was their pet theory. That sort of sounded like the same thing to me, which is interactions take a finite amount of time, so you have to somehow take account of that. Probably given the size of these things, that's not too much of an issue.
Right. I mean, because the amount of time that it would be interacting would still be infinitesimal compared to the distances between the two detectors in something like this, right?
That would be my guess. But you have to remember, the light goes kind of fast.
Yeah,
it's 16 kilometers, but, you know, 16 kilometers versus 10^8 meters per second. Is there still a possibility that if it has a longer interaction time on the order of a nanosecond or something, it would screw something up? And the thing that I really liked, the question that they really had, and they didn't give any reference for, but sounded cool, was how can you be sure that the entangled photons move at the same speed as the free ones?
I'd never heard that argument before.
I've never heard of that before either, but that would be interesting to find out what people think about that, or if somebody's had any experience trying to measure that, right? Because, I mean, that would be an interesting thing. If there's some sort of interaction going on, that should take some energy, so that should do something to the photon pair.
I hadn't thought about it from that direction. I just assumed that if there was something, a delay like that, that it certainly would have been measured by now, because you'd figure when they were setting up these experiments, they would use non-entangled photons just to measure the lengths and the time delays, and then they'd probably measure this exact same times when they did their experiments, right?
That should be what's going on, but they may just measure out the time delays first, right? And then they're looking at the correlations. There should be some jitter in those correlations as well, or some jitter in the arrival times as well. That's what actually gives you the interference. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was just something they made up just for this or something people have been talking about, and it's an open question since I've never heard about it before. But I assume that if you're having information transfer between spots, something like that could be a really important question.
Yeah, I like a good and pertinent question like that. I wonder if these guys have followed up on that and actually done a test.
I don't know. Look for Wang and Wang.
I think I'll do that.
All right. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about in these things?
I'm trying to think if there's any questions that anybody else might have. I mean, it's a huge subject, and you could go on forever talking about all of the different possible loopholes and all the different solutions to loopholes and a lot of theoretical work on the Bell's inequalities. I mean, the literature is just filled with that kind of stuff. And then there's the quantum eraser experiment, the delayed choice quantum eraser experiment, the Wigner's friend experiment. I mean, my God. And they're all related to this phenomena, right? This quantum correlation.
Yeah, let's not try to answer all of those questions right now. If people do think they have pertinent questions, there's comments. You know, you can comment on Podomatic. You can comment on the Physics FM website that where this is place. I don't remember right now which it's Blogspot, maybe. I don't remember.
We have a Facebook page.
And we have a Facebook page, and everybody's talking to you about the solar system right now.
And you can write to us.
There are all sorts of places where you can get a hold of us. You can make comments, you can make suggestions, and we'll try to do whatever we can when we can. We're busy people, so we don't get to as much as we'd like, but you know, we try to get to as much as we can. All right, then. Well, thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Okay, so I will talk to you some other time, all right?
Sounds great. We'll cover some fascinating new topic next time.
All right. Bye now, Randy.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 44, Spooky Action at a Distance. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/44. These show notes include links to papers we discuss in this episode and links to related shows. You've listened so far, I assume you like this program. If you do, I'd like to ask you to consider helping us out by becoming a patron at Patreon. Our Patreon address is www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. And as Randy mentioned, we also have a Facebook place, and you can go to Facebook and interact with Randy. Maybe I'll show up. Usually I stay away from Facebook, but Randy runs the Facebook account for us as well. Bye now.